And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is Let the Market Decide. My first guest is an energy expert who blew the lid off of everything we've heard about renewable energy. He shared the facts about this growing industry and why our energy policies need to be overhauled. My next guest is an apostle of the free market capitalism. Despite the bad rap that capitalism has received over the past 3 years, he contends it's still the best economic alternative. He'll explain how to benefit during these challenging times from his latest book titled The Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always join the conversation by calling 805-639-0008. Jerry Boyer prefers to be introduced as the author of the Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide, a CNBC contributor, and a Forbes.com columnist. With all of those credentials, who would blame him? But Jerry has had a distinguished career. His first professional position was with Arthur Andersen and Company, which was, at the time, the largest accounting and consultancy in the world. Jerry briefly worked as vice president of Beechwood Company, the holding company for mutual fund giant Federated Investors. He started a broadcast career with WPIT-FM, and he hosts the Cornerstone Television's syndicated show Focus on the Issues, which he's done since 1993. He formed Pittsburgh's first free market think tank. He created the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. He's now employed by Salem Communications, which is a Ventura County company, in a number of capacities, chiefly as the afternoon host on WORD-FM in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show, Jerry. How are you doing today?
Great to be with you. The main reason I don't want all that intro is because it tires me out to hear it.
You're a young man, Jerry. You can handle it. You've got broad shoulders.
Now, I haven't worked with Salem for a couple of years now, but I know that a lot of my friends are there, so a shout-out to all my Salem friends. It was great working with them at WORD. And now I'm just doing the Forbes thing and the books and a lot of economic consulting, but it's great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for being our guest. Let's jump right into it, if you will. You're a supply side economist, and you are there with your colleague there at CNBC, Larry Kudlow, who himself was a Reagan advisor, and of course, Ventura County is the home of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Mm-hmm. So, some would argue that supply side economics under President Reagan led us to the current economic collapse of 2007 and 2009. In what way do you find that that's wrong thinking?
I've heard people assert it, but I haven't really heard an argument, and I don't even know what the argument would be, that tax cuts and monetary policy in the early 80s, sat out there as some kind of time bomb, and somehow through some means that the left never explains to us created a housing bubble, even though Ronald Reagan really didn't do anything particularly significant in housing policy. And then that housing bubble, burst many years after Ronald Reagan wasn't president any longer and wasn't even alive. I mean, they'll blame anything on Reagan. and, of course, it doesn't have anything to do with Reagan. Arguably, it would have been worse without the Reaganomics revolution, which gave us much stronger economic growth in the 1980s, so put us in a better position to sort of withstand these kinds of assaults. No, we got a housing burst because we had a housing bubble. And we had a housing bubble for the same reason that you always get bubbles, easy money. Bubbles are made of something, and what they're made of is money. And the more money there is, the more bubbly these things are. And the reason a bubble forms in one place rather than another, the reason a bubble forms in, say, technology and telecommunications in the late 90s, but it didn't form there in the aughts, instead it formed in housing in the aughts, is because government regulation shoehorns capital and credit in certain directions based on choices made by government. So because of the Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996 under Al Gore, they wanted to create this information superhighway. They weren't willing to let the market do it on its own, so they created a set of regulations which ended up creating a tech bubble. And the easy money from the Fed filled that bubble, and of course it burst. Now, what we had after that is a housing bubble because it was a universal principle of government, Republican and Democrat, maybe a little bit more on the Democrat side, but both parties, that somehow the more people owning houses was better whether those people were actually qualified or good credit risks. And so you had the Community Reinvestment Act, which made it very difficult for banks to say no to loans, especially in minority neighborhoods, which led to the creation of the subprime mortgage product. When banks said, this is not a good idea, we only want to lend to people of good credit ratings, the government said, if you continue to take that attitude, you will be punished accordingly, and don't worry about it anyway. You're not going to own those mortgages for the long run. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these government-sponsored entities, will buy them from you. And so that created a huge housing bubble. So, of course, it was going to burst. I mean, you create if you create an enormous credit edifice on a foundation other than prudent lending, there will be a time when it will collapse. And it collapsed when it had gotten too big to be supported by the underlying economic data. But what really bothers me the most is that the people who created that bubble, the Barney Franks of the world, the Christopher Dodds of the world, really the Barack Obamas of the world, as a community organizer who pushed for the housing bubble, they're the people who are hauling the bankers in front of these Stalinist show trials and pointing fingers at them, when the people who are holding the trials are far more guilty than the people who are on trial.
Oh, very interesting and strong words from Jerry Boyer, whose book, The Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide, How to Invest and Thrive in an Era of Rampant Socialism. Let's pursue that line of reasoning, if we can, Jerry, for just a minute, please. You characterize President Barack Obama as a Fabian socialist. First of all, why do you say that, and what makes you come to that conclusion?
Well, I say it because I was raised by one, so I know how Fabian socialists think. My grandfather, who was really my father figure during my formative years, was a union machinist and a Fabian socialist. He read a lot of literature, and Fabian socialism is a variety of socialism that doesn't believe in violent revolution. It believes in gradual socialization through political change. So organized, usually organized labor or other organized interest groups, through a slow process of increasing the size of the public sector and decreasing the size of the private sector, eventually get to the point where the balance of power and the balance of decision-making is made in the public sector, in the government sector. I say that that's the president's view because his arguments are identical to those arguments. And this is what he read in when he was a high school student, when he was a college student. This was the world he was in. And he openly says that in his autobiography. And when people challenge me to say, well, really, is he a Fabian socialist or is he a socialist? You know, prove it. I turn it around on him and say, well, you tell me when he changed. There's no doubt that as a young man, as a college student, that he was a socialist. He's made that perfectly clear in his autobiography. So where's that aha moment where he says, okay, now I understand the failure of central planning? Where's his shift to the center? Where's the book that he wrote when he shifted to the center, or the revelatory article, or the speech he gave where he said, I finally came to realize that central planning doesn't work? There is no aha moment like that in his life. So given the fact that his rhetoric is socialistic now, that his policies are increasing the size of government, and that his background is in Fabian socialism, and right up until, you know, shortly before he ran for Senate, he was open about those associations. And not until he looked at national office did he stop talking that way. I think the burden of proof is on someone to tell me that he's changed his point of view.
All right, we're talking to Jerry Bauer. Jerry, let's talk about applied Obamanomics, if you will, please. You write that applied Obamanomics will lead the United States into a situation very similar to Japan in the from the 1990s to the present. How so?
Well, this kind of economic policy doesn't work, and even as it attempts to stimulate growth, it fails in stimulating growth. And so what you end up is with a period of prolonged stagnation. Now, I do think there is a little difference between us and Japan. So I think we have more a tendency as a country towards inflationary solutions. So I don't expect a Japan, you know, sort of deflation stagnation. I expect America in the 1970s, where government policy, especially regulatory policy, is hostile to wealth creation, causing slow growth, and our central bank attempts to ameliorate that situation by printing more money, which of course doesn't work. But that is sort of standard dogma in Keynesian economic circles, that is, people influenced by the thought of John Maynard Keynes, probably the most influential economist in the English-speaking world of the 20th century.
Absolutely.
They believe that you can cause growth by printing money. What do you get? You don't get growth. but you do get inflation. And that's what happened in the 1970s. I think that's going to happen now. I think it's beginning to happen as we speak.
Okay. Well, that makes it's a very compelling argument that you have there. I was ready to argue with you on the point about Japan, but you've sort of addressed that already, so that's good. We're talking to Jerry Bauer, everybody, and we're talking about what to do during these challenging economic times. So let's turn our attention to that, Jerry, if you can.
Sure.
Let's talk about some investment strategies across a couple of different asset classes, given the current economic and political environment that we're in. Let's take a look at stocks right now. What would you do if you were in stocks? Where would your advice be?
Well, I there's kind of two directions that I take when it comes to equity investing, and one of them I would describe as up and out, and the other is down and in. So let's talk up and out first. Up and out is that the United States is drifting away from economic freedom. It started before Barack Obama. We are now ninth or tenth from the top in the list of countries in the Index of Economic Freedom, and we're trending downward. And so one of the roles of the entrepreneur, says John Baptiste Say, the man who coined the word entrepreneur, is to take wealth from a situation of low yield and move it to a situation of high yield. And so I think that the smart investor will sever the relationship he has now in which his default position is to invest in U.S. investments. That doesn't mean you can't invest in the United States. It just means that the typical American investor, say, of my generation, who came up since Reagan, said, you know, gets up in the morning and says, what do I buy, American stocks or American bonds? Right?
All right.
Remember in Blues Brothers, we, you know, what kind of music? Both kinds, country and Western, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, American stocks or American bonds. And I say, no. America's now just one country among many when it comes to its commitment to economic freedom, at least for now. I don't think that'll last forever. And so taking money from nations that are trending away from freedom and moving it into nations that are trending towards freedom yields a better probability for wealth creation.
So all right.
That's the starting point.
But in that equation, of course, is the risk-reward balance that you have. If you want the higher risk, you're going to move it into a market like the Kopsi market in Korea or some of the smaller markets around the world, which present high risk, high volatility, and the chance that you might not get any of your capital out. Not that that doesn't exist in the United States, but it's even more so in some of these foreign countries. So what do you say to foreign investments in some of these emerging countries?
Well, you raised, I think, the perfect issue. And I think you're asking the right question. Now, would you mind if I challenged you just a bit?
Go for it, sure.
Respectfully, you're arguing from the standpoint of modern portfolio theory, very respectable point of view, that says that risk is volatility. Harry Markowitz, back in 1959, created modern portfolio theory, got a Nobel Prize for it, and he said, well, we need to measure the trade-off between reward and risk. And what is risk? And he thought about it for a moment, and he said, I don't know, I guess it's volatility, it's variation. And at that moment was born modern portfolio theory with all of its virtues and all of its vices. And I would say that there's a vice here. Variation really is not the best measure of risk. If you buy a stock and it moves around a lot, but there's a high probability that when you sell it 5 years from now, it'll be higher than it is now. But in the meantime, it will go up and down and up and down and up and down, but mostly up. Is that really a high-risk investment? As opposed to somebody, if you buy a stock that's not going to move much at all, very stable, but it's fairly likely to be flat or down a little bit 5 years from now, according to modern portfolio theory, that's a low-risk stock, right?
Right. Well, okay.
Right? That's real estate, right? That's real estate right now. Not that variable. And so I say, throw out modern portfolio theory, at least that aspect of it. Markowitz is right. Risk versus reward is the metric, but risk is variation from economic freedom and sound economic principles. So a high-risk country is not a country with a lot of variance. A high-risk country is a country with a lot of socialism. A low-risk country is not a country with very little variance. A low-risk country is a country with a lot of freedom, rule of law, sanctity of contract, and property rights.
All right, Jerry, that's very compelling. We don't have time to go into that any more deeply, so I'm going to switch asset classes on you right now. Talk about commodities, because there has been a surge in the commodities, particularly hards. Gold is easing off of its all-time high, but it's still right up there. Oil is making another run towards $100 a barrel. So are commodities a play that you can make in this economic and political environment that we're facing?
Yes, they are. And I was very much in love with gold, say, a year and a half or 2 years ago. Now, you know, we've gotten to some pretty high valuation levels. And people have to realize when you look at the data, gold is not something that goes up when you get inflation. Gold is something that goes up before you get inflation. Frequently, all of the gold price increase occurs before the inflation kicks in. So historically, you know, it's not a bad time to sell gold when inflation starts, because gold is an inflation predictor, not an inflation measurer. So it was a great inflation hedge. Maybe there are other inflation hedges to look at now, for instance, tips. And commodities in general. Now, here's the nice thing about what I would call productive or growth commodities. They go up in response to inflation, but they also go up in response to growth. So a global growth story, a story in which the world is getting freer than the United States and growing and is hungry, literally hungry, so that's why food commodities have done so well, but also hungry for growth, which is why productive commodities have done so well, but is also inflationary, is a pretty positive environment for these growth commodities. And certainly for consumable commodities. And I think sort of the next big story, I think the 2011 story, you know, is probably going to be a food inflation story. And I think investing in solutions to that, agribusiness, which has been off the radar screen for 100 years, is now going to become an important story.
Oh, well, that is good. And we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Jerry Bauer, author of the book, The Free Market Capitalist Survival Guide, How to Invest and Thrive in an Era of Rampant Socialism. Jerry, if people like what they hear, they like the sound of your voice, want to learn more about you or your book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Well, they can certainly go on Amazon and get the book. We have a splash page for it, survivalguide.com. That'll be easy to remember. Excuse me. Free Market Survival Guide. My wife's helping me out here. FreeMarketSurvivalGuide.com. And I also blog at BoyerBriefing.com.
All right. That is wonderful. Jerry, it has been a delight having you on the show. We'll have to have you back in the future. Thank you so much for being a guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
My pleasure, Billy.